Imagine you are a child. You are a child living in Canada in 2018. You go to school, as does every other child in this country. But for you, something is different.
At your school, you are missing many of the basic materials, programs, and support offered at the school across the road. Why? Because you are First Nations, and you live on reserve. And the Canadian government has decided that because you are First Nations, your school should not receive the same funding as every other public school in Canada.
Today, the Canadian government denies thousands of children the education and services they deserve due to their race and ethnicity. Many Canadians perceive both education and equality to be cornerstones of our society. If we truly believe this, how can we accept the continued conscious racial discrimination by the Canadian federal government towards children?
This is the first part of our podcast on Indigenous education in Canada, recorded by the McGill Chapter of Journalists for Human Rights. My name is Amisha Parikh-Fries.
And I'm Clara Cook. Our organization seeks to use grassroots journalism to bring awareness to human rights and governance issues in Canada and around the globe.
Today, the issue hits very close to home. In this part of the podcast, I interview Cindy Blackstock, an influential activist from the Gitxsan Nation, about a Canadian Human Rights Tribunal case revealing the government's discrimination towards First Nations children.
In the second part of the podcast, I interview Kenneth Deer, an activist for Indigenous rights, especially regarding education for the Indigenous community right here in Quebec. We will have more on who he is and his prominent role in resistance to the many areas of discrimination faced by the Aboriginal community in the second part of the podcast, so stay tuned. But first, Amisha, would you mind telling us more on your work?
So I spoke to Cindy Blackstock in her office on a blustery winter morning on McGill campus, where I am a student and she is a professor in the Faculty of Social Work. Cindy is also the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. In 2007, Cindy and the Society filed a complaint alleging that Canada discriminates against First Nations children by consistently underfunding their education and welfare on reserves. A lengthy legal battle ensued, in which the federal government put Cindy under illegal surveillance, challenged the jurisdiction of the Canadian Human Rights Act, and tried to dismiss the complaint altogether. Finally, in 2016, almost 10 years later, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal issued a momentous decision. Yes, it ruled, the Canadian government does discriminate against 163,000 First Nations children due to their race and ethnic origin, and they should stop immediately.
So after receiving this ruling from the highest national judicial body on human rights, did the government cease its discrimination?
Astonishingly, it did not. And the tribunal issued three further orders expressing concern that Canada wasn't doing anything, and also linking the government's non-compliance with the deaths of two children. As of June 2017, the Trudeau Liberals alone had spent more than $700,000 trying to fight the tribunal's decision. Every day that we continue to allow the government to do this, we put more and more children in danger. Cindy tells me more about this issue.
Well, this discrimination actually dates back years and, in fact, decades in Canada. And it's shocking to many Canadians because people don't think of the federal government racially discriminating against little kids. But this has been going on for a very long time. The reason for it is that the federal government, as part of its colonial practices, imposed provincial and territorial child welfare, education, and health laws. They refused to fund anything to do with First Nations traditional practices for child welfare. And so those laws apply on and off reserve, provincial child welfare laws. But the federal government funds it. And what the federal government has known almost for two decades now is that it provides far less funding for child welfare services than every other Canadian child receives, even though First Nations children have higher needs. So back in 2000, in a joint report that was actually commissioned and participated by the Department of Indigenous Affairs, the amount of the shortfall was about First Nations kids getting 78 cents on the dollar compared to other kids. And the finding back then was that the huge shortfall was in the area of services to keep families together. And because there was such a shortfall there, that meant that First Nations children were going unnecessarily into child welfare care at rates that exceeded the attendance of residential school. So we had another wave of First Nations children being removed unnecessarily because of the Canadian government's policy.
You mentioned that First Nations children have higher needs than non-Aboriginal children, and this is also what you mentioned in your opening statement at the Human Rights Tribunal on First Nations Child Welfare in Ottawa in 2009. So what specifically are some of these needs that you're referring to?
Well, as a result of residential schools, what we had is the multi-generational impacts of that trauma being passed from one generation to another. So that's one thing that results in higher needs. But the other thing is just the compound nature of these inequalities. Just imagine yourself if you're a First Nations child, and you're going to get about 30 cents less on the dollar to stay safely in your family, even though your family's suffering from the multi-generational impacts of residential school. You're going to get about 40 to 50 cents on the dollar for your education. You're going to be perhaps in one of these 1 in 6 First Nations communities don't even have clean water to drink, and some have no sanitation systems. You will also receive a lack of comparable funding for health care. You add up all of those inequalities and you situate them in a society that doesn't know any better and therefore often judges you and your community as if you're getting more. And that creates a hardship and a toxic potion of inequality that piles up on the hopes and dreams of First Nations kids. And that's why this discrimination is so dangerous, because it's done by the government, it's done consciously. It creates situations where children start to internalize the racism and start to think, well, the reason I can't get to university is because I'm not smart enough, not because if we applied a 40 to 50% cut on every student in elementary and secondary school, I think we'd see university enrollment drop dramatically. But that's how the First Nations kids see it, and that's why I think we see such horrendous suicide rates in First Nations communities across this country.
And so you worked as a child protection worker in BC, I'm assuming working closely with families and children from different backgrounds. Did you notice the impact of this institutionalized discrimination while doing this work?
It was really interesting. I worked in child protection in North Vancouver and also in the downtown east side of Vancouver, so in metropolitan areas. And I did that for close to a decade working with the province. And as you say, with people of all different types of backgrounds, it was an absolute honor to work with those families. Then I literally crossed the street in North Vancouver to the Squamish First Nation, where I worked as a social worker there in child protection. And when I was working in the province, I'd liaise with their workers and they would talk about the inequalities. But I thought, oh, it can't be that way. I mean, it's just across the street. But then when I went to work there, I was absolutely flabbergasted at the basic things that we would provide for families without question across the street in North Vancouver were not available because of the federal funding on reserve. And it was fundamental things like trying to get a child with a disability a wheelchair or a lift so that they could go upstairs without having to crawl on their hands. Those are basic things that without question we would provide off reserve, but on reserve, I had to do raffles and fundraisers. It was stunning to me. And that's really what got me on to this injustice. I could not believe that in our own country, you just had to cross the street and children were worth less because of their race.
Once you began to realize the impact of this discrimination, you, along with your employer, brought the human rights complaint against the Canadian government in 2007, and the case was only recently closed in 2016. So did any aspects of the Canadian legal system that you encountered discourage you or question how our legal system is set up to protect or deny people's rights in the face of government discrimination?
A lot, actually. I was both encouraged and discouraged at the same time. I was very discouraged that the Federal Department of Justice and the Attorney General of Canada, who are supposed to really be upholding the laws, too often in this case were either interpreting the law narrowly so as to perpetuate discrimination, or in at least three occasions, they broke the law. while they were trying to get the case dismissed on legal technicalities. And when I say that they broke the law, that's not an opinion, that's a matter of law. So in three cases, they, for example, consciously withheld at least 90,000 documents, highly prejudicial to their case. And they were only caught doing that through an access to information request. The tribunal found that behavior to be, in the words of the tribunal, far from irreproachable. This other two relate to surveillance on me. The government deployed 189 different federal servants in justice and Aboriginal affairs to monitor my personal and professional movements. And we know from their own documents it was in hopes of finding some other motive for the case so they can get it tripped up. So the conduct of the Department of Justice was far from what I would hope from a government department that's supposed to uphold the law. Where I was encouraged is actually with the tribunal and with the courts themselves. I was encouraged that you can go to these places, and although it is a frustrating process in terms of the long delays that people often experience, especially when we're talking about children here. This case went on. We'll come up to the 10th year anniversary, and we're still fighting against the government of Canada. Just think of what's happened in a child's life in 10 years. But the courts and the tribunal, particularly this last panel, were very respectful. I think they were extremely fair, and that gave me a lot of confidence in the Canadian legal system. I think, though, that Department of Justice, there needs to be some serious reflection and reform within that department to make sure they're acting towards all Canadians in non-discriminatory ways.
During this case, Amnesty International, for example, was listed as an interested party. What role do you think that human rights groups or other activists have played in fighting for the Canadian government to recognize its discriminatory practices?
Well, I was so grateful to Amnesty International. I'm not sure if you know that just yesterday they released their report on Canada, and they gave Canada a failing grade in its implementation of the tribunal. So when Amnesty got on board, it really signaled a fundamental shift in the way that human rights groups have operated in Canada. I think this is a moment really for perhaps a courageous conversation about human rights groups in Canada. We need to remember that they were alive and active at the same time that repeated reports were coming out from the residential schools of the profound abuse and indeed deaths of these children at the hands of the Canadian government and the churches. And the human rights community basically did nothing about it. And for decades, these inequalities in public services have been known to human rights groups in Canada. They've been known or should have been known to them because they were a matter of the public record. And yet, if you look historically back at the annual reports of many of these human rights groups, very few of them ever expressed any concern to the government officially or to the public. And today, I think there's still room for significant growth. I don't understand, quite frankly, why racial discrimination by a federal government towards 163,000 children is not top page news of every human rights organization in this country.
So on that note, in what ways do you think that other advocacy groups or the public can get involved in this case?
You know, the way that we talk about racism and discrimination is almost like it's going to be obvious when you see it, right? And then the question is, what do you do about it? But I always say the biggest challenge is seeing it in the first place. Canada is home to the only race-based piece of legislation in the Western industrialized world called the Indian Act. We have a Department of Indian Affairs. If we had a department of any other, you name it, any group of diversity, that would raise alarm bells for Canadians. The government of Canada today still measures people's blood quantum who are in First Nations to determine whether they are, quote, status First Nations or non-status First Nations. Like, these are glaring racial discrimination measures that, in fact, were studied and implemented by the South African apartheid regime. And we advocated against that regime in South Africa, but we allow it to be normalized in our own community. So to the question of what people can do, the Caring Society's created 7 free ways for every caring person to make a difference that cost you absolutely nothing. You go on to fncaringsociety.com and you're going to find those 7 free ways. And one of those ways is related to this case. It's called the I Am a Witness campaign. And what we did is we loaded all of the Government of Canada's documents on this case, all of our documents. We don't ask people from the public to take a side. We believe that good people will make up their own mind about what's happening. We just ask you to watch. And this case is now being followed by well over 15,000 individuals and organizations around the world. It is the most watched human rights case in Canadian history. And in fact, I was down at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights talking about Canada's non-compliance with the order in January, because they're not compliant. And that's not, again, my opinion. So we do need more and more people to get onto that website and say, hey, Canada, stop racially discriminating. Go see your member of parliament and send Justin Trudeau a tweet.
So you said that the government's not complying. What steps does the government of Canada need to take now?
You know, I get so frustrated sometimes when I listen to Government of Canada representatives saying, oh, this is a complex matter. Well, they treat all other children in the country equitably. And Canada, as a matter of routine, does complex things. Let's take, for example, the good work it did, bringing in over 30,000 Syrian refugees in just a matter of months. So it is clearly able to do complex things quickly when it's motivated. You have to have the willpower, and it does not have the willpower right now. And that's where we all come into it. We need to make sure that we say, it's not enough to say you care about Indigenous children when you're racially discriminating against them. You need to comply with these tribunal orders. So what it would look like is that First Nations children would have an equitable opportunity to live in their families. That means that they're probably going to need more money for child welfare than other children to make up for that multi-generational impacts of residential school and the compound hardships of Canada's inequality in child welfare. But we need to understand that these inequalities in child welfare appear in health services, water, education, and Canada has good reports on the book showing how far it's falling short. So it's going to cost money. What I said to the Finance Committee is this. You're telling us that you can't afford to treat First Nations children equally, that the only way that you can pay various programs for the government is to racially discriminate against these children. I said, but what are the children losing to? The National Post had an interesting article responding to that question. They found that the federal government had spent $7 billion on flagpoles and tennis courts and other projects like that, and then came out and said, we don't have enough money to remedy this discrimination immediately. I think Canadians are better than this. We need to demand better from our government.